All right. Enough with the Mendel love. I'm tired of saying good things about the guy who was good in his time. Today we're going to talk about a lot of the situations in which Mendel's rules and ideas fall apart. Actually, we will be spending the vast majority of the rest of the semester talking about things that Mendel could not comprehend. So, thanks for getting the ball rolling, Gregor. We're moving on now. So remember, when we're talking about genetics, the big idea is you've got two copies of the same gene at the same locus on a chromosome, and if you've got two versions of that same gene, you've got two alleles, and in Mendel's world, one of them would be dominant, the other would be recessive. Okay. And the first modification, or the first example in which that doesn't work out well, is incomplete dominance. We talked about that a little bit the other day, but here's an example. We talked about with the eggplants, remember the other day, with the purple and the white, and you get the light purple in between. Here's an example of incomplete dominance where you've got a really dark red flower and a white flower, and you can have this range anywhere in between. So they don't exhibit an either-or when you get heterozygotes. So two main things that were variations of dominance that we're going to talk about are incomplete dominance and codominance. Okay? And at some point, the definition of one of these things is going to start looking like it could roll into the other one. And that's not a bad thing. That means that you're actually thinking through it far enough to realize, wait, there's more at this than meets the eye. So incomplete dominance, if you think about a blending with that, if you've got red and a white parent, you wind up with a pink, you got a purple and a white, you wind up with a light purple. Incomplete dominance, the phenotype is someplace in the middle. And it's different than either parent. With codominance, what we're really seeing, some aspect of both parents is present in the phenotype. So if you've got a red parent and you've got a white parent, in codominance, you've got flower petals that have patches of white and patches of red. Okay, both are expressed. And the problem is, you get pink by expressing both red and white. It's just that in incomplete dominance, it's an even distribution. In codominance, both are expressed, and you see individually aspects of both parents in codominance. And that's just what I told you. Okay, then there's another problem, big problem. We'll revisit incomplete dominance and codominance several times. But there's another thing, penetrance. And sometimes you can have two individuals that have the same alleles, and the way in which they express them are different. Okay. So we're starting to understand the reason for that. So you could have two heterozygous plants for flower color, and one of them expresses a much darker red phenotype than the other one does. And it's the idea of to what extent do you express these alleles? Penetrance is usually depicted as a percentage. So if you've got a percentage of individuals, or if you've got 100 individuals, how many of them will express a phenotype for a particular genotype? Okay, so if you've got the genotype where we should see you've got massive tufts of hair coming out of your ears and you don't, congratulations, you won the penetrance lottery. Those genes, you've got that genotype, but you're not expressing that phenotype. So penetrance is not always 100%. And one of the things, particularly when we get into the sections on molecular genetics where we're talking about gene regulation, when we're talking about developmental biology, that it came about, this idea came about when we were sequencing genomes. So in the very tail end of the last century and the first 5-6 years of this century, everything was about getting the genome for the organism. Actually, at the time, was working on the bacterium that had was the first living organism to have its entire genome sequenced, Haemophilus influenzae. And everybody thought, that's it. We know everything that we need to know about this organism now, that we understand every gene in its genome. We understand where they're located. We can go in. We can play around with it. And that's not the case. The labs that were researching good biological questions on Haemophilus influenzae are still the ones in business. The ones that just followed the genome in on that organism didn't last very long. Same thing with human genome. We understand the genes that are there, but you know, we didn't cure cancer 3 months later. We don't have gene therapies for any diseases at this point in time. Right? So one of the things that we had to appreciate was just knowing the arsenal of genes in the genome is just the start of the story. And the example that I use that is Billy Ray Cyrus had exactly the same notes that Mozart had at his disposal, right? That's like having the same genomes. It's not the notes that you have available. It's the timing and the magnitude of expression that makes the difference between Achy Breaky Heart and a song that people actually want to listen to, okay? So in genetics, it's not whether you've got a gene or not, okay? It's, is that gene expressed? When is that gene expressed? And to what extent or magnitude is that gene expressed in combination with all these other thousands of genes? Okay. So penetrance is a big part of that. Just because you've got an allele or two alleles, it's not 100% guaranteed that they're going to be expressed so that you'll get what the expected phenotype would be when some poor student someplace sits down and does the Punnett squares to see what your phenotype should be. Okay. And so that ties in then with expressivity, which is the degree to which a character is expressed. From 0 to 100, how far up on the slider are you in terms of how actively is that gene expressed? Then there are alleles that can kill you. And they're referred to as lethal alleles. And they almost always have their effect during development, so that the individual isn't even born. Okay? It's the individual would be dead in utero, would die. And so when you start looking at the ratios of genotypes and phenotypes, you get unusual ratios because the individuals that had the lethal alleles aren't represented in the birth. So here's an example. In coat color with mice. So we've got brown, yellow, or blonde, and dark or black. So what happens is if you get two heterozygotes that are yellow, so both parents are yellow, you can get, so anytime that you're crossing single trait for heterozygotes, you should get a 1-to-2-to-1 genotypic ratio. And a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio if there's complete dominance, a 1-to-2-to-1 phenotypic ratio if there's incomplete dominance. So what happens is you get 1/4 of them that will be homozygous recessive. They will be not yellow. So depending on whether this other gene, the recessive gene, was for black or brown, they will be a color other than yellow. Okay. And half of them will be yellow, and half would have the genotype heterozygous, and 1/4 would have homozygous dominant. Homozygous dominant is a lethal condition. And so, as graphically shown, this little pup rolls over on its back, kicks its limbs up, and stops developing. So you don't get these represented in the viable offspring. It's still following Mendelian rules, We've got a 1-to-2-to-1 genotypic ratio. This would be a 3-to-1 phenotypic ratio, except now since this is lethal, what we see is a 2/3, 1/3 phenotypic ratio. So whenever you see a 2/3, 1/3 phenotypic ratio, that should scream out homozygous lethal condition, okay, for the dominant. If the recessive is lethal, you're never going to see anything other than the dominant. Okay? But if you see a 2/3 to 1/3 phenotypic ratio, then that's the dominant in the homozygous condition is lethal. So if you were just the person doing these crosses, you would never see a 3-to-1 ratio. You would think something's going on with your mice. But it's just a lethal condition. All right, some other things are you can have more than two alleles at a single locus. We've been talking about the fact it's an either-or situation. You get the dominant one or you get the recessive one. Right? You get tall or short, round or wrinkled. But in many loci, there are more than two alleles that can be present. And some of them can still exhibit complete dominant, complete recessive, and others act more as codominant. So let's take a look at some of these. I know this has been keeping you awake. You probably wonder, what's up with mallards? Right? So this is how mallards get their patterns. That it's referred to as restricted phenotype is the more subdued brown with some blue colors on the wings. So here we've got the mallard coloring, which is the green head, sort of the burgundy chest. Then there's another one called dusky, where it's sort of a dark charcoal color. Sort of black to dark gray, a lighter belly, and then that color continues on the back. So there are three possibilities with mallards: restricted, true mallard, and dusky. And that's a result of if you do this cross where you've got, here's restricted and dusky times mallard and dusky. Okay, so mallard and restricted are both dominant over dusky. Okay, both of these have a dusky allele, but this one has a mallard, which is dominant over dusky. This one has a restricted, which is dominant over dusky. So when they cross, when the two dusky alleles come together, you will get a dusky individual. Okay. If you get mallard, this mallard allele coming over and combining with this dusky, you'll get a mallard. Okay. If you get this restricted allele coming over with this dusky, it's just like this parent then, you get a restricted. And then in the championship match, when you get restricted with mallard, restricted is dominant over mallard. So you would get a second restricted individual. So you would wind up with a 1-to-2-to-1 phenotypic ratio, but it's not for the reasons that you would expect, that there are actually three alleles at play. Two of them are dominant to dusky. Restricted is dominant to both mallard and dusky. Okay? So three alleles at play. There is true dominance and recessive at play in each of those possible interactions. The example that of codominance, again, trying to tie things in to make it human-centric when we can, is the ABO blood type. Okay? And my guess is you guys have had this before. We'll go over it in here. It makes really nice, easy homework problems and test problems. Before, I think Paul Garris has taught 197 now for 3 years. Team taught with Alan Katz in 197 for like 9 years before that. And in 197, we really wanted to do a blood typing experiment. And we were told, nope, we can't do it, that the IRB board, we would have to write up an IRB full protocol to have you guys do it, to, you know, sample your own blood and then type it to see what blood type you were. And I thought, okay, well, they turned us down because they're worried about infection, so we really ramped up. Okay, we're going to have them wipe down their thumb with betadine first, and then they'll wipe it with an alcohol swab at the end, and we'll give them antibiotic laced Band-Aids to put on. And that wasn't the reason at all. The reason why they wouldn't let us do this is because the genetics involved, it's possible for someone to have an outcome, and if they know the blood types of their parents, they could have an aha moment where they realize that perhaps mom and dad, one of them is not, it's usually dad. Mom usually was there or she wasn't there, and you know that. But paternity could have come into question. And so for us to do that lab in 197, what IRB wanted was we had to have counselors in place to deal with the emotional trauma of a student realizing that dad wasn't dad. So this is what's going on. So with the, and when I was in human genetics, we would get large families that would, we would get DNA samples from, and we would look for certain patterns of phenotypes and try to identify the gene involved. And 20% of families were kicked out because when you start looking at the molecular banding pattern of what genes came from what chromosome, there will be a child in the family in which there's no possible way that dad lines up with him. And it was referred to as the milkman syndrome, is what we call it. But then the entire family gets kicked out in human genetics lab. You just don't say, okay, let's look at everybody but that one kid. The entire family gets tossed out. So it's one of the reasons why I didn't like human genetics was you would spend all this time using this family and the lineage, find like three markers that show that dad can't be that kid's dad, and you have to go back and factor out all of that work that you factored in into the table. So, men are just dogs. They don't appreciate all the damage they do at home and in labs around the world. But okay, so what's going on with the ABO blood type is they express an antigen on the outside of red blood cells. Okay. So an antigen is just any structure that your immune system will see. And the thing is, if you express one of these antigens, your immune system has developed to ignore it. Okay. So if you're type A blood, that means you express the A antigen, your immune system will not react to the A antigen. Because it's used to seeing it all the time. The last thing that your immune system wants to do when it's functioning normally is start attacking your own red blood cells. Okay, so there are three alleles that are present. In some cases, they're written A, B, and O. In this particular book, they're written IA, IB, and just I. And O or I is really a lack of a full antigen. You make the molecule most of the way along, and then you stop short of adding the last couple of side groups on it so that it behaves like an antigen. So O is really a lack of a recognizable antigen. Okay. All right. So if you have... So we've got three possible alleles, right, at a single locus. And to be type A blood, which is what all the cool kids are, you can either be, you know, your book will say the I thing. I always grew up just writing them as the name. So I'm going to do that in here to save us all time writing the I with a tiny little A or B or O. Okay, to be A, you could either be homozygous for A, or you could be AO. O doesn't make an antigen of its own, so if you've got one copy of A and a copy of O, A is the only game in town. You will express A, and you won't express anything else, so you'll be type A. If you're type B, then same type of thing. You can either be BB, or you can be B and O. B will make an antigen. O won't make one in this case, so B will be the only antigen made. When you do a blood test, you cannot distinguish from a homozygous for B and a BO heterozygote. Okay? Can't distinguish a difference. So the phenotype's the same on there. Let's see, AB, that's an easy one. You have to have both an A and a B. This is an example of codominance, where we're incomplete dominance, you do something in between. Codominance, you have aspects of both that are present. So in the case of an AB, both the A antigen and the B antigen are produced, and both can be detected. Okay? And the way that they're detected is with antibodies that recognize the specific antigens. So we do an agglutination assay. That's what this slide is showing. If you've got an antibody that recognizes an antigen, then it will cause the red blood cells to clump up. So these are examples of clumping. If they don't clump, then they stay in suspension. This is referred to as a hemagglutination assay. And so you just look whether the red blood cells are clumping or not. If they're clumping, that antigen is present. So here we've got B, anti-B antibodies. So any of these that clumped will be producing the B antigen. Here we've got the A antibodies. So any one of these that clump will be producing the A antigen. So A's and AB's will clump. Here B's and AB's will clump. Okay. And yeah, they made a mistake on this slide. Alright. And then O, there's only one way that you can get O. You have to be homozygous for O. And O will not produce either antibody or antigen. Okay? So you've got a red blood cell. Okay? And on A, they're making A antigen that's on the outside of the red blood cell. With B, they're making the B antigen that's expressed on the outside of the red blood cell. With AB, both are expressed on the outside of the red blood cell. And with O, neither A nor B is expressed on the outside of it. Okay? So actually in this diagram, O shouldn't interact with any of these. AB should interact with all of them. So they got these two rows mixed up, and the editor didn't catch them. So in fact, what happens is, so in our lab that we wanted to do, for example, if you find out that you are AB blood type, and you know that dad is O, that's an impossibility. Okay, because the only way to be AB is you get an A from one parent, a B from one parent, and their dad is sitting with two O's. Okay, so they're, before Maury Povich came along and we had DNA-based paternity tests, the first thing they look at is blood typing to see if, with this combination of parents, can we have an offspring of the kid's blood type. And in some cases, you can exclude parentage by the blood type, just based on this combination of alleles playing out. Okay. But the other thing is just the biology. You know, if you've got A blood, that means that you make antibodies against B. Okay, so if we try to put any blood in you that's either type B or AB, you will have antibodies against the B antigen that will attack those red blood cells. So that's why you have to give somebody, you try to give somebody a transfusion with the same type of blood. Okay? They do a quick typing test, try to get a bag of the same type of blood. But this is where, as a rule of thumb, you should not get your biomedical information from either soap operas or from former Playboy playmates that think vaccines cause autism, as a rule of thumb. But Soap operas, they're always this thing. It's usually at the holidays. Bo and Hope were in a car crash or something. Bo and Hope still alive, by the way. They're like in their 50s at this point. And somebody has a rare blood type. AB is the least common type of blood. And somebody's bleeding out on the table and they're AB and they only have one unit of AB blood and this person's going to bleed out. And that's when we find out that, oh no, Patch is really Bo's son who time traveled and then came back and he's an exact AB match and they could just hook him up side by side at the tables that they often do in soap operas. If you're AB and they only have one pint of AB blood in the fridge, it doesn't matter. You've seen both the A antigen and the B antigen. You don't make antibodies against either one. We can give you any type of blood we want, and you're not going to reject those red blood cells. Okay? So anytime you see a drama where somebody's AB and it's really tough to find blood for it, it's not ideal, but people who are AB blood type are considered the universal recipient. We could give them any type of blood, and they're not going to have a problem with it. On the flip side of it, if you are type O, the Red Cross really likes it when you donate. And that is because your blood does not have either antigen on it. So you're the universal donor. They can, in an emergency situation, they could put your blood in anybody. Neither of those antigens are on there. They shouldn't get rejected. So ideally what they try to do is give you the same type of blood, but in an emergency they can give you O, or if you're AB, they'll just give you whatever's about ready to run out of its life expectancy on the shelf. You get the bargain bin blood when you go in if you're AB. Okay? But it's true codominance and three alleles at the same locus. And we'll be doing some problems on this when we get to the pedigree. It's really pretty easy to do a human pedigree using blood type. All right. Some more exceptions. Gene interactions. And gene interactions are just cases in which we've focused so far on everything is determined by what's happening at a single locus. And they're pretty discreet. You can get multiple alleles, but it's still, we're just looking at the genotype at a single locus. With gene interactions, this is the way that many gross physiological traits play out. These are genes involved at one locus affect the expression of genes at a second locus. Okay. And the particular mechanisms that this happened by are numerous and vary. I'm not going to expect you to remember them. Remember when we were talking about gender development the other day, about the SRY gene. It's a single gene at a single locus, but then it ultimately affects the expression of dozens of male-specific genes across multiple chromosomes. Okay, so that's a gene interaction, where something, one locus affects the expression of genes at another one, and you can get then these novel phenotypes. So here's an example. So we've got peppers here. Sorry, from a distance, I thought they were pumpkins, but they look like peppers now up close. It's either peppers or pumpkins. I'm going with peppers. So in this case, we've got two loci that we're looking at, and we've got true breeding lines when we cross. They all look like this. Okay, we'd say this one's the dominant. Then we cross the F1s, and this would be where if things were just going according to Mendelian rules and they weren't linked on the same chromosome, we would expect 9 to 3 to 3 to 1 between the two traits, but we're really only looking at one trait, so we would expect 3 to 1 here, but we get 9 to 3 to 3 to 1 for one trait. Okay? And that's because these two loci are working together to make a single trait. Even though they're not linked, the fact that we got a 9 to 3 to 3 to 1 ratio tells us they're not linked. Okay? So they separate independently of each other, but both of them come into play to... both of them come into play to express this pattern. So we've got the creams, which were the recessive when we did got the F1s. The creams were recessive to the reds. So that's 1 out of 16. Okay. The reds are 9 out of 16. So the dominant for both of the alleles gives you the red. And then when you get dominant for the Y locus and recessive for the C, you get peach color. And if you are recessive for the Y, dominant for the C, you get orange. So you get two variations of those, one dominant, one recessive ones in the mix. So two loci, each with two possible alleles. They separate independently, but both are involved in the same process, the color of this fruit. Okay, so those are actually fairly common where you get gene interactions where more than one allele are responsible for the overt phenotype that we see. There's a particular gene interaction called epistasis. And epistasis just means you can get relationships of multiple loci in which one of them just completely trumps the other. That the others can play out, but if you have a certain allele at a certain locus, it doesn't matter what happens at all the others. That this one will mask what's happening at the others. Let's see. And the reason for that, we will look at the ABO blood type again, that there is an epistatic relationship in here. And usually where you see epistasis is in biochemical pathways of several steps. So here's how those antigens were actually being produced that were present on the blood cells up there. You start out with this intermediate precursor. Okay? If and when you guys take biochemistry, you're going to learn all these multiple-step pathways. You get comfortable with the idea that typically there's an enzyme involved in each of these steps of the pathway, and that enzyme will be encoded by a single gene. So here to go from the intermediate to compound H, which is the second precursor in this pathway, you have the H gene, and that's has two alleles. The recessive then doesn't convert this intermediate to compound H, and that's how you get the O antigen. Okay, one version of the O antigen, the truncated version. If you do go to where you get the dominant at the H, then you add this new side group to the precursor. You get the second precursor, compound H. Okay. Then at the next locus, that's where we've got A, B, and O. Okay. Where we were doing the genetics before, it's assuming all starting with compound H. If you've got A, you add terminal sugar to this that makes it the A antigen. If you've got B, you add a different terminal sugar that makes it the B antigen. And if you've got just O's, you don't add a terminal sugar, and compound H is recognized as the O antigen. It's neither A nor B. Okay? So that's the pathway. And when you think of epistasis, more than anything, if I see you on the street 5 years from now, and I ask you, give me the most common condition in which epistasis takes place. You go, Nichols, epistasis takes place in multi-step biochemical pathways. Okay? And that is because if you have recessive, your homozygous recessive at H. Okay? So we'll say an individual is okay, so here's one locus, here's the other locus. If they are HH, or recessive, homozygous recessive, and AB, what blood type are they going to be? Right. They're going to be O. Because they will never make compound H to which you can add the terminal sugars. And so H is epistatic to the second locus. The ABO locus. If you're homozygous recessive at H, it doesn't matter. All of these look like O. And so this locus trumps what's happening here. It masks the effect of what combination of alleles you have at the second one. And that's just because you need this precursor expressed. So in a complex biochemical pathway, reverse that. Okay, so these are different molecules. We've got molecule number one, number two, number three, and number four are in a biochemical pathway. And each of these requires an enzyme to modify one to turn it into two, a different enzyme to turn two into three, a third enzyme to turn three into four. Each of these enzymes are encoded by a gene. Okay. So if for some reason you have a mutation in B, okay, you would not be able to make molecule three. This process would stop at molecule 2. So if you had a mutation in gene B, right, or you've got an allele that's non-functional, sorry, a mutation, we could think about it being a recessive allele that doesn't produce 3, that would be epistatic to gene C. And then gene A, same thing. If you've got a version of A that's not functional, you're not converting 1 into 2. If you don't have 2 to work with, there's no substrate for enzyme B. There's no substrate for enzyme C. A would be epistatic to both B and C. So the closer you get to the start of a biochemical pathway, the gene encoding that can be epistatic to genes downstream. Okay? But sometimes what happens in biochemical pathways is you have an alternative pathway that can produce the same molecule. So if that's the case, then you don't pick up on the epistasis because 3 is being produced whether it's coming through this direction or from up here. So we don't always detect complex biochemical pathways by epistatic relationships if there are multiple processes that produce the same product. Okay. But much of biochemistry was worked out by genetics, where they would make mutations, they would figure out, and it works the other way around, that our understanding of genes involved in a pathway were worked out by biochemistry. Biochemistry and genetics are sort of two sides of the same process, where the genes encode the enzyme that carry out the function. And someday when we have a little bit more time, I will tell you an old story of a retired geneticist and biochemist and how they approach their disciplines while trying to figure out how cars are manufactured. Okay, but that's epistasis. And that would be recessive. Here's an example of dominant epistasis. We're not going to... For the most part, I want you with epistasis to realize that it's... earlier acting genes in a pathway can have an effect or an epistatic relationship with ones that happen later, but there are ones that are dominant. And so when you look at these Peter Pan squash, that you can have yellow, you can have the green marbled, or you can have white. And this is actually an epistatic relationship. White produces a compound that, through the production of an enzyme, results in this green marbled. That, if you've got a second enzyme present, will produce the yellow color. So depending on if you've got both of these enzymes present, You'll be yellow if you just have one, but not two. You'll be this green marbled. If you don't have one present, you'll be white. Okay, but it's a dominant epistasis. We're not really going to go into that. I want you just to think about this: why it's epistatic. That if you lose one, you'll be white. You won't have the chance to be either green or yellow. So that would be epistatic to enzyme 2. All right, then we've got one which all hell breaks loose: duplicate recessive epistasis. Nope. Life's too short. If and when we offer an advanced genetics class, we'll talk about that. This isn't the day to confuse you with that. But again, epistasis, most typically found in multi-step biochemical processes where the gene encoding an earlier acting enzyme has an epistatic relationship with those later. All right. Complementation. Complementation determines whether the effect is caused by a single locus or by a different locus. Okay. And as a molecular geneticist, complementation is really important to the way that I study things. You can complement in bacteria as well as other organisms. But the idea with complementation is, a lot of times, geneticists study things by breaking them. Okay? Geneticists go in and we induce mutations to make genes lose their function, and then we characterize what's not working. If we want to know what a gene is encoding, you make it so that it can express, and then you look to see what's wrong with that organism. And a lot of genes we can't do that with because the gene product is so important that the organism can't live if we knock it out. But in many cases, we can cause mutations, look and see what's going on. So we'll say that we're looking at an organism, we'll make it really easy, that we make a mutation in gene A. Okay, so gene A is no longer expressed, and when gene A is expressed, so a lot of times this mutagenesis is random, where we'll just take the organism, like in bacteria, we'll take the bacteria, we'll put them under UV light for a long period of time. Those of you that really like that George Hamilton Costa Rican tan in January, sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but the way that scientists induce mutations is to expose things to UV irradiation. So good luck with that. But that's what we'll do. We'll put bacteria under a UV lamp, very similar to a tanning lamp, for about 10 minutes. That's usually enough to induce multiple mutations in each cell in the petri dish. Pull it out. We can also subject into some chemicals that do it. And then we look for messed up phenotypes. And then we try to track it down to a particular gene of interest. So we'll say that we knock out gene A, and our bacteria, when gene A is functional, say that they make nice round colonies. When we get a mutation, that they make rough-looking colonies. It's actually a way that bacteria interact with each other determines whether they make a nice smooth colony or whether they make a jagged colony. And so our view is gene A, it causes this colony formation. But if you do that and you submit the paper, the editor, or if you send your thesis, your committee members are going to say, well, you did random mutagenesis. Is it possible that it's the effect of another locus? How do you know it's really gene A that's doing it? So you do a complementation study where you take one of these messed up ones that has a non-functional version of gene A, and then you give it a functional version of gene A. And you see what it looks like. And if it really is gene A that's causing the change in the phenotype, when you add the functional version of the genotype to this altered one, you would expect to see the wild type or normal phenotype expressed again. If for some reason it was over here in another location, it was gene X, So we'll say this is really gene A is the cause of this. If it's an unknown locus, adding the wild type version of gene A back is not going to make the difference. So complementation is a way in which you demonstrate whether or not it really is a single locus that's responsible for the phenotype that you're seeing. And the way that you do that, you add a normal or wild type allele back. All right. So we've been sort of building up to this. We've talked about things in which there's more than one locus at play. We've talked about there are multiple alleles, more than two alleles at each locus. Now we get to the really interesting genetic determination of coat color in dogs. That essentially all the variation that you see in coat patternings of different breeds of dogs is determined at four loci. The agouti, black, extension, and spotting. Loci. So four loci. Now, I mean, not a huge number, but some of these have multiple alleles that are present. So you don't have to memorize this. This is just an example. But there's some... Oh, yay, beagles. So I've got a 16-year-old beagle at home, so I'm kind of partial to beagles. But part of me will be glad when she casts off the mortal coil and I could sleep through the night. My 4 hours that I need, she usually wakes me up about halfway through there. So what some of these are involved in, whether or not you actually express pigment. Right, so that's going to be an epistatic gene. Whether or not that pigment is brown or red really isn't that important if you're not making the precursor to the pigment. Extension. Whether or not the pigment being produced at the skin actually gets into the coat, the hair follicles themselves. That sometimes you can express the pigment, but it doesn't make its way into the hair. And so that, again, would be an epistatic locus. So two of these loci are epistatic in some respect to the others. The others are whether or not you get spots, but spotting can determine whether the extension, whether the pigment is making it out to the hairs or not. So there's a really complex interaction between these four. And you can look and see that some of the more common breeds, what they will have with respect to their possible genotypes. But it's all based on these four. Let's see, I'm trying to think. There's Dalmatian. So Dalmatians have a specific allele for spotting that determines the relative density of the spots. And so you get predominantly a white background with a lot of smallish black spots. If you would genetically engineer, so you take that allele out of a Dalmatian and, say, put it in a German Shepherd, you would have a German Shepherd with a lighter base coat that had spots of the darker coat color across it. That's one allele at the spotting locus that gives Dalmatians that appearance. Okay. So we're not going to go into great detail in this, but you don't have to move in or include very many parts to get a very complex genetic system. Okay. That's the take-home of this, that four loci, about a dozen alleles at two of the loci, and then the other alleles are just either a yes or no. But with epistasis and codominance, you can get a lot of variation. Okay. So we haven't wandered too far away from Mendel at this point. We've just been talking about some really basic modifications, and now we get into a system in which Mendel never would have been able to predict. When you cross a Basset and a Dalmatian, what's going to happen with their coat color? And in fact, now breeders have a pretty good idea. I mean, breeders understood these before we had names for the loci and the alleles. That families that were involved in long-term breeding with dogs kind of knew how to do this, just like farmers that were involved in making hybrids kind of understood corn genetics much at a pretty high level before we told them what the names of the genes were that they were manipulating. But now they have these tables to work with, and they can predict if they want to try and come up with a variation of a new breed that they can specifically try and cross dogs for coat color. And coat color does a lot in terms of selling dogs. People tend to make their first dog purchase based on the way that the dog looks. Later dog purchases are based on the dog's interaction. You know, is the dog friendly? Does the dog, you know, border collies are really good looking dogs, but if you live in an apartment, a border collie will wear you down because they like getting out running. They will corner you anytime you come home. They just like being out there moving things around. But if you just look at it, oh, it's a pretty dog. It looks like a, you know, miniature version of Lassie, kind of. So breeders are out there trying to figure out what dog people will buy that first time just because it looks cool. Apparently now the trend is shrinking things down to the size that they fit in pretentious young ladies' purses. And I cannot believe the places in which people take dogs now. And they're not the little, you know, they're not the assistance dogs, or they're not the, you know, now people can get cards that say that I keep my dog with me because otherwise I may have a panic attack kind of thing. These are just, you know, Bassets walking through Cub Foods at 1 in the morning, and no one at Cub Foods ever thought that's not a good idea. But so portable dogs is a huge thing. I'd say if you want to make a huge amount of money, go figure out like how to have a toy, you know, chocolate lab or something that people could tote around. And then there's the king of dogs, the beagles. Yay, beagles. So they're actually noted. There's some features here that they have this black saddle shape. That's one of the patterning genes present on beagles. So this black across their back. And then they have a white tip on their tail. Beagles are rabbit hunters and fox hunters. So the white tip on the tail, you could see it out in the grass. So that's why breeders maintain that. They have boxy heads and the ear flaps. Dogs that are diggers have the big floppy ears so that their ears are protected when they're sticking their heads down a hole. So when you look at dog breeds, most dogs were functional, much more than just, I want a really cool dog to take to the park so all the young ladies are going to want to come up and pet my dog and maybe I'll get phone numbers. Guys, the one thing better than dogs, babies. Borrow a baby for the afternoon. Take it. If you've got a cute baby and a beagle at the park, yeah, have your schedule open for the rest of the weekend. You are golden. But and actually, my dog, this is not a picture of my dog. This is from your textbook. My dog is really unusual in that she doesn't have much of the black saddle. About 5% of beagles won't have the black saddle, and then the beagles tend to have really dark eyes, and my dog's name is Mobridge. Mobridge has pearlescent green eyes, and that's about 5% as well, so she's really unusual. She's also the smartest individual in the house. My dog essentially trained me that she would start rattling her dish when she wanted either food or water, and then she got to the point that she would just, when it was empty, she would just pick it up, bring it into the living room, and set it down in front of me, and then I would get up and do it. And then, after, I don't know, she was about 18 months old, she would bring the dish in, I would get up, get her food or water, I would come back, and then she would have taken my seat. She would jump up in the chair. So she didn't want food or water, she just wanted my chair, and she was giving me the head fake on that one. So I knew at that point, all right, I'm the beta dog in this relationship. All right. Much like right after we talked about everything Mendel, then we talked about, well, wait, some things are tied in with sex determination and sex expression. And that is true that there are many traits that even though you have the same genotype, that they are expressed differently based on gender. When we start talking about quantitative traits, ones that are determined by how many genes that you have, so it's something like skin pigmentation or height. So height being the example we're going for here. Basically, your height range is determined by how many tall genes you have. Okay? So if you've got two tall parents, you're more likely to get more tall genes. You're going to be taller. But if a male and a female have the same genotype for height, the male will typically be a few inches taller than the phenotype. Just developmentally, males will keep growing longer than females, so males will tend to reach a higher height with the same genetics as a female. So there are some characteristics that are either sex-influenced or sex-limited. So first we'll talk about sex-influenced. And so the example that we have here, I know you were thinking, man, we've seen mice, we've talked humans, we've seen a lot of plants. Bring on the goats, Nichols. Come on, where are the goats? Well, here are the goats. Okay, so we've got a beardless goat. It's a well-kept secret among the male goat community that not all male goats have beards and not all male goats eat tin cans if you turn your back on them in bad comedies. And then we have a bearded female. All right, tough life being a bearded female. Maybe not so much if you're a goat, but you have a rich, full career in the circus ahead of you if you're a human. Okay, so the beardless male and the bearded female will cross, and we've got different alleles here. Here's the bearded. And so in the Mendelian world, you'd expect all of the F1s would look the same, but they don't. All of the males will have beards. All of the females will be beardless. Okay? So what happens is they've got exactly the same genotype. They have one of the beardless alleles, which is the B+. They have one of the bearded, which is the B, little b. Okay? And females, if you're not homozygous, right, the heterozygote will be beardless. In males, the heterozygote will be bearded. So if we want to go back to Mendelian terminology, in females, beardless is dominant to bearded. In males, bearded is dominant to beardless. It's the same alleles, right, interacting, but it's just the larger gender context that changes that relationship between dominant and recessive. Okay, so that makes it sex-influenced. If we do the reciprocal cross, so now we've got the bearded male and the beardless female. So one parent, so here we're actually doing the F1s here. We cross the F1s. Then you get all kinds of combinations that come out. But again, keep in mind that bearded is going to be dominant in the male. So you get ratios that don't follow the Mendelian rules, but they're determined extensively by the gender of the organism. So if you know the difference in dominance between each gender, you could go through and calculate these if you want. I'm not going to expect you to do that. I just want you to understand that sex-influenced is when there's a difference in dominance recessiveness based on which gender it's in. Okay, then there's sex-limited characteristics. And we're going to look at roosters and hens for this. So if you take a look at the difference here, this is what we would typically think of as a rooster tail. And this one, not so much. This just looks sort of like a regular chicken tail. And this would be the hen. That's a rooster with a smaller tail. Oh, that's all I had. I didn't show any of the genotypes. Okay. So with sex limited, only one of the genders can express a particular phenotype. Okay? So none of the hens in the world will have a rooster tail in this particular lineage. But you can have male roosters that either have the rooster tail or they have the more subdued tail. Okay? So males can express either phenotype. Females can only express one. Okay? So that's what sex-limited means, that both phenotypes are not possible for both genders. With the sex-influenced, with the goats, both genders can express both phenotypes. It's just that dominance-recessive relationship is altered in them. So that's the difference between sex-influenced and sex-limited. It's limited in that only one gender is limited in what it can express. Okay, cytoplasmic inheritance. I've mentioned this just in passing a few times, but all of the mitochondria that you get come from mom. Okay? And in cell division, the mitochondria randomly are divided. Okay, there's not a mechanism comparable to mitosis for mitochondria, in which they all line up and you make sure that you get one of each type. It is tough being a mitochondrion. Okay, you're cranking out energy, but you're doing these reactions in which you are generating a lot of free radicals. And so as a result, mitochondria, hopefully you remember from your intro biology class, mitochondria have their own chromosome. It's much like a bacterial chromosome. It's a big circle. It's got genes on it that are required for the mitochondrion to do its work. And so free radicals cause damage to DNA. They cause mutations. So your mitochondria are just beating the daylights out of themselves just by their daily job. And so over time, what happens is you get mitochondria that accumulate different sets of mutations. That makes the lineage of that mitochondria less efficient than some others, depending on what genes have been dinged up and to what extent they've been altered. And so you can have lineages of really efficient mitochondria and lineages of much less efficient mitochondria in your same cells. And if they always divided evenly, you'd be okay. But what happens is in some cell divisions, you get where all the blues go this side, all the reds go to that side. We'll say that these are really efficient ones, the blue ones not so much. Then these descendant cells have all the efficient ones and these have all the inefficient ones. Those cells will function differently. That it will be tough for this cell to meet its energetic needs. Okay? Whereas this one will be fine. In this example, there's some difference, but they're not quite as bad. So mitochondria are inherited randomly. Mitochondria have chromosomes inside of them, and it's very common for mitochondria to have damaged DNA as a result of high concentration of free radicals around. Free radicals do the same thing to your DNA and your chromosomes, not just the mitochondria. The more exposure you have to free radicals, the more likely DNA damage is, mutation is. The main disease that we tend to focus on in terms of genetic damage is cancer. We'll have a few lectures in here about cancer. It typically requires two mutations in specific genes to change normal cells into rapidly replicating cells, a benign tumor, and the second mutation can result in a benign tumor becoming malignant. So DNA damage is a part of the process of cancer. And so the way that you can minimize damage by free radicals as much as possible is through antioxidants. So there are certain vitamins and nutrients that are antioxidants. You could take those all you want, but if you live to be 90, you're going to have DNA that's been damaged. Just through the biochemical processes of staying alive that long. So to a certain extent, cancer is a disease of nothing else killing you before cancer got a chance to in later stages. So we'll talk about that later. So here's an example of a non-human example of cytoplasmic inheritance is if a plant pigment is encoded by a mitochondrial gene. And if you get those uneven distributions, that you can get something called variegated, where variegated is sort of a marbled. You've got green and white patches on the same leaves. That's just the cells in that leaf. Some of them are expressing it, others aren't, because of the uneven distribution of in this case, the chloroplast, not the mitochondria, but an organelle being divided in the cytoplasm. All right, maternal effect. Gosh, snails now we're throwing at you. Okay. So, snail shells can either be a right-handed or a left-handed helix. Okay? And so here we've got dextral, which is a right-handed curve. So I see you're all doing this, you're all doing that. This is sinistral, which just means left-handed. If you're left-handed, you're sinister, is where the origin came from. And so we've got the genotypes that are shown. They go through meiosis to produce the gametes, and they come together, and then what you see is they will look like mom. Okay? That the genotype really... Okay, so they all look like mom. In this case, they're sinistral. Okay, we'll look. Then if you do the F1s and allow them to self-fertilize, then what you get are dextrals. And they've got different genotypes. Okay? And so what happens is it's the allele that they get from mom, and it's the environment and love that mom puts into her allele that really matters. So you can have the genotypes really don't matter as much as maternal factors at play. And so people spend a lot of time trying to figure this one out, looking largely at the genotypes involved. It's not the alleles. It's the maternal effect of mom having the bigger effect than dad on this. Okay. And so that leads us into something called genome imprinting. And that is, after your parents married and then they decided to have kids and they gave each other that very special hug, then what happens is it's just not a matter of an equal genetic contribution playing out based on Mendelian rules, that there are some ways in which either mom or dad can say, yeah, I know you got genes too, but mine are more important in this case. And so what happens is, for genes to be expressed, you need to relax some structures that we'll talk about in a week or two. But if you modify the DNA, you can increase dad's expression of genes or mom's expression of genes in kids. So what happens is the egg and the sperm, the DNA is modified so that some genes, they're basically defaulting to whatever mom's got is what's going to be expressed as the kid is developing. In some cases, it'll be dad. In humans, there are some pretty good studies now that are showing something that people have thought for a long time, and that is facial symmetry in newborns tends to be very dad-driven early on. Babies tend to look like dad for the first 4 to 6 months of their life. And the reason for that is, as I joked about earlier, mom's involvement in baby is pretty obvious, right? But in human history, there could have been multiple candidates for dad. And then if the kid comes out looking like mom, everybody just kind of throws their hands up and they don't know. But if the kid comes out looking quite a bit like a certain male, then it's like, oh, all right, then I'll stick around. I got this one. I'll go out and... And then what happens? That's why on the Maury Show, it's usually like four guys that look a lot alike, so that are there for the DNA testing. But babies tend to look like dad so that dad realizes and dad hangs around and gets involved in nurturing that. Later, that imprinting relaxes a little bit and you get more maternal expression. And so kids tend to look at age 5 more like a blend between mom and dad. But you basically get dad junior that comes out of the womb. All right, we'll stop there for the day.